Yeah, different sound to it. Sprightlier.
Thank you. you're so bleak, get it back, stitch it up, and come right back to where you started again. Let your soul bleed and stitch it up, they say there's a hole in your soul.
You played it like at the June,
yeah.
Or perhaps at your house?
Oh, I don't know.
Recently.
Shine the butt of the knee high.
I can't even turn around. No, I'm afraid to write the song.
Yeah.
No. I know. Wait, I don't really have any.
I don't have
any extras.
Okay.
Well, that's good.
I feel like I'm singing falsetto.
That's actually tuned correctly, really.
I know it is. I'm tuning it down.
Oh, yeah, no, I know. It's not so much tuning it down. It's
you wanna die.
But it's tuning it back, I'm afraid I'll break. If I tune it back, I'm afraid I'll break the thing.
All right.
All right.
I'm going to read you a sequence of poems now, based upon a Greek myth, the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. Are you familiar with that myth?
I'm very familiar with Orpheus and Eurydice. She turned the stone into something.
Well, I'll give you the dime tour through the myth. Orpheus was born the son of a one of the nine muses. And some god. He was like sort of semi-immortal. What? Yeah. And his thing was, he would play the lyre, and his lyre had the power to charm people, beasts, even rocks and trees. It was the magic of music and of art. Well, one day, one fine day, Orpheus fell in love with Eurydice, who was an oak nymph. And while accounts of their love story vary, the bottom line is they married, and shortly after they married, either on their wedding day or shortly thereafter, Eurydice was bitten by a viper, and she died. And she went to the underworld, which is where they would go in the Greek myth when they died. Carried across the boat to Hades and everything. Across Styx, yeah. And Orpheus, who was completely tragically dumbstruck by the whole event, elected to chase her into the underworld and to try and retrieve her. And so he brought his lyre and he went into the underworld and he charmed all of this, all the... That's coming up, yeah. That's the other part.
I know it now.
And
I know
that. So he chased into the underworld. And he played his case before the king and queen of the underworld, and he played his lyre so sadly and so mournfully that he made all the evil demons weep. They all took his side, and it was agreed that he could have Eurydice back so she would not die her untimely death, and he could bring her back to the above world. But the catch was, as he was coming up the path, he had to not look back.
Right.
And I think he was accompanied by someone. He was accompanied by like a denizen of the underworld to make sure it was on the up and up. So he looked back, and Eurydice was gone. And the last thing she said to him before she disappeared was farewell. So he arrives above ground, and now he's worse off than he was, because he's lost her, and now he's lost her again. He eschews all female companionship. He refuses to marry again. That gets the local women riled because he's an eligible widower, and it is deemed appropriate that he eventually, after a period of mourning, take a new wife, but he refuses to do that. And as a matter of fact, in some accounts, he not only refuses to take a wife, but he begins, much in the manner of Socrates, to keep the company of young boys. In any event, the whole thing gets out of hand. And this group of women called the Maenads, they get pissed and they stone them. They stone them and then they rip them limb from limb. They just rip his head off his trunk, his arms, throw him in the river. And in some accounts of the story, even after death, his head is floating on the river and his lyre, which they've also thrown it over, floating along, head disembodied from the body, and the head is still speaking. It's still prophesying. And the lyre is floating on. Finally, It's all retrieved, and it's buried at the foot of Mount Olympus, where it's said that near the grave of Orpheus, certain kinds of trees grow very fruitfully. So, the Orpheus myth has many variations. There are a number of films based on it. I did lots of research because it's... I saw Black Orpheus. I came upon that like on TV one day, and I thought, wow, I'm researching Orpheus, and here's this movie. I'd never heard of it. And it's like, wow, it's just, you know, whatever. So, in any event, the bottom line is this past summer, while I was reading about all this, I wrote a poem about it. And then I got a job working in Boston at a corporation. And every day I would have to take the train in during rush hour, packed knee to toe to eyeball to follicle with thousands and thousands of other individuals, far too close. I found that the only way I could deal with this morning rush hour every day was to write. So I decided, I'd written this one poem responding to the Orpheus and Eurydice myth, but I thought to myself, well, what if I were to take this initial poem and break down the myth into the various constituent parts and write a series of poems, much as Rilke did. And so what I'm going to read you now is the initial poem, the sequence, and then a poem I wrote to conclude the series. Okay, so the first poem you'll recognize, Jim, because I read it at the last meeting. You might recognize it, you might not, but it might. Some of it might sound familiar. And it's called Making the Lyre. Begins with an epigraph from Rainer Maria Rilke from the poem Turning Point, 1914, which reads, "Behold, O innermost man, your innermost maiden, fought for and won from thousands of natures, she that was only one up till now and never as yet a creature beloved." One. Secret unfoldings of pulse amidst the crude talking surfaces, a dream cruising along coalescence, blood, youth, dimensions of sensation. Stripped of movement, merely a girl god, merely a star, a waiting, a live meal. I want to taste her lips as they are tasting. I want to follow her into evanescence. Two. She flings the thrill of wet stars across what is hard. She dapples difficulty, steers thrust, conceals her absence among shadows. But forgetting and falling, she becomes again a language conceived for acquiescence. She is bitten, eaten, chewed, but nothing changes. Everything burns down. Three. Toward midnight, she is less rising eyes and swimming smiles, taut implosion. Her dew is drying, making ready, finding the larger cups, the durable reservoirs. She is the snap of metal, hands measuring the fence's limit, doubts faced to the wall. What shall be, her flesh has long been told. Her back is stoical, but her blood is tickled with peeping deep, with peeping dreams. Four, unwrapped in the darkness, she chases the moment's desire. Contrived to open, to receive, she fits among hands and mouth. She waits for the universe's eyes to approve her, hovers lightly near falseness. Something about to bloom in this world, something about to die. Five, her lover levitating amongst her forest of pink-cheeked dream music. The urge to caress, the power to ripen, the compulsion to own, to cage and burn, to say, you are her, and you are not her, and I love you, and bend back more. To find her last shadow, her haunt, her heart trembling, dress her in acquiescence and a new mane. Six. She moans, breezes of notes, a bruised being, a struck thing, a cage of whim and laughter. No blood stirring where not bone directed. She is a feline convulsing from buttermilk and conquest. revived when pelvis's lock and blur, now sinking, now revived when newly clutched. 7. Morning, resurrection, consequences of dream. Nude, soft, her sister on a canvas. Remembering, love, her door is bright again. The young day, open hands, covered in eyes again. Her body is still young, its surface unmarked. She is learning to ride the universe. It will play her henceforth. She will learn to be played. Now we begin the sequence proper. Eurydice, pale torso arriving. Desire brushes along her shoulder and passes on. Sway of the crowded train like a fairy, a blowing grove. Sinking into tunnel, small roses fill the darkness. Darkness swaying, roses falling, watchful bright planes. Voices float in the early morning. She turns and doubts. Desire splinters. She is becoming invisible, as low as a thing named. Eurydice, remembering, taken amongst the leaves. She has heard this song before. Love fragments her and she is possessed. There is a stream young and noisy, twisting, prideful through her forest. It resists the lyre's preachings of the new. It watches the trees and rocks, all lonely, bend. It is nightfall before the stream is taken. The lyre has smiled and agreed to relent. Its music is settling softly elsewhere. The stream watches, the stream listens, considers freedom. This song is for her, about dreams no one knows. She is never sated now, love has no bottom. Eurydice in the underworld, blankness beyond color. She spreads her girlhood upon the ground, and upon it her icons. Afternoons of stillness, blinking impatient dreams. Partly unfilled wishes, unfurled wishes. But new song scratches at her blood. New song taps her secret blouse, her within's within. New song plucks her slowly, our eyes to heart to toes. She is stretched until her girlhood threads snap. Her hands awake as from a young life's cage. Her future now holds not leaning but standing. Her future is a squalling icon waiting to be taken. Eurydice in the underworld, exhaling, again. She is leaving time and her need for light. She continues to see, seeing and following is her habit. Though she keeps looking up, there is only blankness. Her memories are the only stars here. Something he'd said about love called her his music. Something he'd said about love, he'd been wrong. The blessed noise of love has not followed her here. Her stars are still twinkling as darkness descends. Her stars are still shining, but saying goodbye. Eurydice in the underworld letting go. She feels a light snap when the love disappears, the ragged break of a bone that has never hardened, a lost sense of eternal watching, of hope, the freedom of a final goodbye, moaning. The falling and healing that was life will not continue. First moment bereft of older brothers and younger sisters. First moment when the fountain is not fed. Broken. Broken because no longer a moment. Bright. Blindness. Where she walks, cities no longer rush. Where she walks, no trees, no tears. Stillness. The snake bite of mortality is over. The broken bone is merciful. Leaves no dust. Eurydice in the underworld, all not as it seems. Letting go involves a final choice, a release of the singing, a release of her song. Denying mortality its last prayer, denying that faith even here approaches. You have been seen where you stand not seeing. You have been heard though your face seems gone. You're being approached in this silent aloneness. Hope hums around you. Hope bothers your death. Not quite an eye begins to cry out. Not quite an eye convulses dead melody. Letting go involves a final choice. The melody strikes my blood again. She is young again. He will find her. He begins to run. Orpheus encountered, still amongst his songs. There is no grave. There is no underworld. Music doesn't know of silence or of falling. Her colors have not faded yet. She's still on this side of time. I continue to play our wedding song. The rocks and leaves continue to vibrate. She continues to await my hands and tongue. The birds await our resumed happy noise. There are soft figures and crowded talk. I continue to wait. I continue to play. Her sisters have taken her to find fresh colors. They make me impatient. I rile the trees. Some songs are not so gentle, will not end. Orpheus takes up his instrument again. The world rattles dryly upon its mount. I strum again and not even the bones move. I try again and the music snaps free of the day. The music is atrophied to one sickly note. The music has dried into a scorched noise. The world lies next to its dead mount. There once was a dance amongst a cafe of trees. That day blue eyes floated in a rippling space. The world was two soft arms. The world recovered its first note. I strum once more, for the world cannot end today. I look to the birds. They listen, shift, huddle. I cannot stop playing. The world cannot end today. The music is too young. I cannot die. Orpheus arriving in the underworld. Here one stops falling. Here one ceases. What's left is just presence, not good nor evil. There is no path. There is no will. Those around me neither crowd nor give way. I think Eurydice. I repeat, Eurydice. But I have always been here. I am compelled from without. Something doesn't want me here. Something potent is frighted here. It's my hands. They disturb. They vibrate. I speak Eurydice. I sing Eurydice. This word means nothing. I begin to fly. Something flashes before my eyes. My hands vibrate faster. Orpheus in the underworld, searching for his wife. I sing to another Eurydice, blank-eyed maiden, one who has forgotten her womanly music, her girlish daydreams, the way she felt amongst the temples at midnight, the way lilac brushes in bloom erupted in her heart a never slow enough dance, and her several sweet admirers never knowing she sought the truth behind their howling shows of strength. They will not show me my Eurydice, these silent moving powers here, so I choose to send a message by ripples, a denial of the denial of beauty here, of dawns that do not end, and the ever-renewing virginity of life, called first love, true love, any love, the music of hopeful spiritus, the ringing of today's first chimes. Orpheus in the underworld, writhing forth. I remember watching the palace cat savage its half-dead prey, its paws curious but dissatisfied, lazy. For a moment, however, the victim fought back, chose to engage in its own death. No twitter of birds, shiver of leaves, no colors to play to, eager children of the light, no groves of noise in which to find songs. Only a tired waiting, resolved now into floors and walls. I remember you singing Eurydice unto sleep, even following a little way in, curious, wondering what sentiments her new knowing and her servant dreams would exchange, wanting to hear my music there, her within's new master. It was still daylight, but I had plans for my young wife, involving moonlight and a sloping hill, involving more knowledge. They recognize that kind of arrogance here. They touch my face with curious paws. Orpheus in the underworld, singing for his wife's return. I do not tell the truth, though there is conjured wind in my song. and a blonde specter blows through it. No, there is no truth here, and nothing lost as of yet. There is the skill that makes afternoon fancies, no more. I begin to tell the truth. Release some of the golden breath I've held till now. The blonde specter now has a face, a smile, speaks a word. The invisible powers here rearrange themselves. Nothing happens. Nothing moves. I'm no longer sure of the truth. My blonde specter is fading again, and I remember but thinly our wedding day. I remember better her lawn of paint pots and brushes, her head leaning forward as she made my songs in the colors. Inside the truth, there is no preaching. There are still the doubts besetting all men. But wearing a stinging belt of hope, one begins to work. My espousing flames are now oak trees. My blonde specter is now a woman, her underworld bondage a small passing. The truth radiates a cold flaring here. The truth adjusts in its throne, does not smile. Returning from the underworld, the faith that marauds. There is a sudden breath, a long inhale of decision, and then there is another breath, and, though unable, the dead move. There is briefly time amongst those who cannot. There is the return of song for the throatless lost. There is the random shift of love, and a soul is unlinked. My lyre is now my carriage, a storm moving away. My lyre is now my retreat, an illicit and final candle. My lyre now contains my faith, for I don't know if she follows. The permanent rust of death is nigh upon me, the release from breathing, time, song, and love. There's even a moment when doubt is lovely, says, this is your cure. With the only hope that does not reveal itself, I move again, with the only faith that all sinners know. Returning from the underworld, the secret spire, the within's within. Something else, Eurydice. Another way than your lazy forest life and the iniquitous crowdings of men in cities. Men, trees, gods, the latent governance of ecstasy. Are you listening, woman, in your following silence? When you were a child, humming, a bud, I watched you, yes, and surrounded you with sourceless music, full of suggestions and spells, one spell. There was a covenant. My lyre was anointed in dream and blood. I could play my heartbeat. I could play a stone's heartbeat. Something fine and potent had begun. Wife, I failed to tell you any of this. Something else, Eurydice. Yet I couldn't be sure of you, sure that you would agree. Protecting you, composing my ascending song. The musician has taken a wife, a nymph, a mystery driving in and revealing the fruits of his heart. I'm still playing heartbeats, even now, even while conducting you promised back home. The song is the viper's. I have to end it now.
Shoot.
This is a lecture that was first delivered at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania in 1935.
Mm-hmm.
No lines from Blake are more familiar than these. To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour.
Mm. Like that. I like that. I didn't know that was from Blake. I heard that.
Eternity in an hour. It might well be the title chosen by the man who attempts to discuss the subject of William Blake in 60 minutes or thereabouts. But there is another quatrain of his about eternity that affords some comfort. He who bends to himself a joy does the winged life destroy, but he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. If we wish to live in Blake's sunrise, we must not bend him to us. Bacon says that there are some books that must be chewed and digested, and in one sense you must dig deep into Blake, as you would into a problem in an integral calculus. But in a deeper sense, you must just throw a kiss to him as he flies by, as he says, I give you the end of a golden string, only wind into a ball. It will lead you in at heaven's gate built in Jerusalem's wall. Jerusalem is Blake's word for liberty.
I didn't know that.
Taking Blake's hint, all I shall attempt tonight will be to give you the ends of a score or more of Blakesian strings in the hope that to some of you, some one of them may prove to be a golden one. That is all any poem can be. You've got to do the winding yourself. The right way to approach any writer is in his own spirit. Enthusiastic admiration, says Blake, is the first principle of knowledge and its last. So I shall not get into Blake's faults, which were many, but shall begin in place of biography with four moments in his life. By the way, if any of you need reminding, he was born in 1757 and died in 1827. Blake was a great believer in moments. All great events, he says, start in the pulsation of an artery. There is a moment in each day, he tells us, that Satan cannot find. One day, when he was about 8 or 9 years old, he encountered such a moment. He came home and told his parents that he had seen a tree filled with angels, bright angelic wings bespangling every bough like stars. His father was about to give him a thrashing for lying when his mother interceded and saved him. That is one of the earliest glimpses we have of him. The last one is in the words of a woman neighbor who was by his bedside when he expired. She went home and declared, "I have been at the death, not of a man, but of a blessed angel." A tree filled with angels, a blessed angel. What Blake saw as a child, he beheld as a man. He became what he saw. We all do, he held. He became it not immediately, and not without many an unangelic moment on the way, but in the end. He whose face gives no light shall never become a star, is one of his fine sayings. His face did give light, and though it took a century, Blake is now recognized as a star of first magnitude. The world is full of plans and programs and proposals for progress, for something better. But what we need to strengthen our face is an actual sample of something better. No longer talk at all about the kind of man the good man ought to be, says Marcus Aurelius, but be that man. Where are the great and wise men, asks Jung, who do not merely talk about the meaning of life and of the world, but really possess it? Blake was one of these rare men, obscure, almost unrecognized, often close to poverty. He went quietly ahead, consecrating himself wholly to his work as poet and creative designer and engraver, upheld by the faith that he was speaking to future generations, he said, by a sublime allegory. Two of the moments I have spoken of contributed powerfully to that faith. One was a moment of revelation, one of decision. Watching by the bedside of his dying brother Robert, he distinctly saw his brother's soul rise from his body, clap his hands for joy, and ascend.
Wow.
The other moment was of a very different character. One day, in Blake's 46th year, while he was living at Feltham and enjoying under William Haley the patronage that promised him his first steady work and rescue from financial worry, he came home and found a drunken soldier in his garden. The soldier refused to budge, whereupon Blake, who was a small man, took him by the elbows and marched him out of the garden and 50 yards down the road. The soldier retaliated by trumping up charges of sedition against Blake and having him arrested. He was acquitted, but the incident symbolizes a turning point in his life. Why should so pacific a man have resorted to such violent actions on such slight provocation? Blake, with all his wisdom, couldn't have told at the time. But looking back, we can see. For the past several months, he had been weighing a supreme decision. Should he go on taking orders and doing hack work for Haley and have plenty to live on? Or should he go back to London, to poverty and freedom? Now, a garden is always and everywhere an emblem of creation, and a soldier is an emblem of authority. It was not a drunken soldier, it was William Haley in symbolic form whom Blake, without knowing it, ejected from his garden and pushed down the road. Soon after, he left his patron and returned to London, fulfilling words he had spoken of Haley a few months before. He thinks to turn me into a portrait painter as he did poor Rumney, but this he nor all the devils in hell will never do.
Cool.